It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 132. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Chad.
And I'm Keeper Murph. This episode, we've conscripted a couple of help persons to lend a hand. Welcome to the King of Sentinel Hill Press, Brett Kramer.
Hello, hello.
And welcome also to Mythos veteran and childhood friend, Nick Brzezinski.
Hi there, everybody.
Hey. Nick is a contributor to Arkham Gazette, and he's also my own, I like to call him Cthulhu Godfather. He is my first keeper of all time.
Congratulations, Nick. I'm sorry that you had to introduce this child, but I'm glad you did.
I still have no regrets.
I am happy you did it.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
All right, let's get into the Campus Crier. We've got a few items here. The Campus Crier is Miskatonic University's student paper. Here's where we go through Mythos-related news and feedback to the podcast. And this episode was recorded on September 11th, 2017.
First up, Dustin Wright, a resident of Rockport, Texas, and longtime Chaosium employee doing their customer support, is currently dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. A GoFundMe account has been set up to help support him. This will help ensure that Dustin's immediate needs are met and offset some of the costs he's associated with temporary living arrangements. Please feel free to donate whatever you can, and we have a link to that GoFundMe in the show notes.
And also, Chaosium released a series of statements on Kickstarter projects that are licensed under the company's name that have kind of gone fallow. And we've talked about a lot of these before, one of them, Horrors of War by Adam Scott Glancy, Punk Town from Miskatonic River Press, and two Kickstarters that I wasn't as familiar with called Writhing Dark. These are cards, I take it, from the description. These are all as yet unfulfilled, so it was interesting to see them sort of slowly reviewing some of their delinquent projects. So they said just after Gen Con that they met with Scott and discussed Horrors of War and decided to extend the license. We've already talked about the reasons. He had some personal issues and wrote a long description of what happened, and you can read that. We'll have a link in the show notes.
We also had a statement for the Punk Town Kickstarter from MRP, but it says they have 50% of a preview of the book that was recently shared to backers. I've seen that. And the second half is in the actual final stages of layout, and I believe Angus is doing that. Chaosium has decided to keep the Punk Town license in place for now and hopefully see this much delayed project through to completion in the coming months.
And so on the Writhing Dark Kickstarters, there's actually two out there that have not been fulfilled, and those they're basically just because of the backers are going to extend the license, but it's a special license that won't be extended afterwards. It is just for fulfilling the extended edition Kickstarter rewards, and will expire. That's Shane Tyree, who has not fulfilled those two licensed Kickstarters. One is Writhing Dark Playing Cards and Tarot, and the other one is Writhing Dark the Extended Edition. 1,626 backers pledged $116,000 to Writhing Dark.
Wow.
I think that's combined. I guess he's really kind of gone silent. Chaosium has encouraged Shane to reopen channels of communication with the backers. And
apparently they had proof that he actually has actual product in hand, though. That is mentioned in the statement as well.
Right, so. And that was part of the reason for them deciding to not just cut them off. So, the news here to me is that it's interesting that Chaosium is doing this, that they're kind of going through their backlog of projects that are unfulfilled. There's a meta statement going on there, I think.
I think so. Up next, we have two releases for Trail of Cthulhu. The first is Out of the Woods from Pelgrane Press. This is a new scenario anthology for Trail of Cthulhu with a forest focus. This features five scenarios by Adam Gauntlet, Lauren Roy, Chris Spivey, Ruth Tillman, and Aaron Vanek, containing extensive handouts, maps, and pre-generated characters for each adventure.
Also up from Pelgrane is Cthulhu City. And that is a setting for Trail of Cthulhu. You can use it for a full campaign or as a diversion for your existing game. Investigators are in a strange, corrupted version of Arkham. And humans that live in the city seem bizarrely normal on first encounter, but time reveals that there's more beneath the surface.
If I may, I think they also released two individual scenarios for their Cthulhu one-to-one. I think one Dex Raymond adventure and one, what's the other investigator's name? Ruth Tillman wrote it, so it's the female investigator, and I can't remember her name suddenly. But those also have just come out as well. They're having a busy month.
Up next, Andrew Lehman is reading a retelling of Lovecraft's The Picture in the House with famed Italian horror composer Fabio Frizzi providing the soundtrack. The release will also feature liner notes by weird fiction scholar S.T. Joshi with composition notes by Fritzi. This is all released by Kadabra Records for about $32 on their website. This is for an LP, by the way. They also have a liquid blood-filled version, that's in quotes because that's what it's called, available for about $195 on the website. Kadabra has also released a number of other a number of other readings of Lovecraft accompanied with beautiful scores on their website. It's also worth checking out. We have links to all that in the show notes.
Blood-filled, what the hell would that possibly... It's an LP with liquid inside?
I just want to change my name to Fabio Frizzi.
Yeah, that's a fantastic name, dude. Fabio Frizzi. If you guys haven't checked it out, there's a soundbite actually on the original article, the Fact Mag article that I linked. There's a soundbite of Lehman starting the story and the background music. It is cool. Really cool.
Keeper Chad appeared on Legends of Tabletop on their podcast for the Necronomicon wrap up, and we'll have a link in the show notes. That's all I want to say. But it was interesting. Discussion for sure.
I can't talk. Go ahead.
Yeah, Massive Nyarlathotep, the companion.
I've never heard of this.
Got a lovely review on Lovecraft e-zine that's worth checking out. And, you know, it's really just an excuse to mention it again because it's a great book and full of great content.
Did you know you can still buy a copy on the Chaosium website?
I wasn't aware. How would I possibly do that?
You'd go to the Chaosium website and buy the PDF for $47.95.
That's fantastic.
90% of which goes to yogsothoth.com.
I should have picked it up at Necronomicon. I didn't. I saw it and I went, I'm going to get that. And then something else.
They had a copy at Necronomicon?
Yeah. Yeah, they did.
Yep.
And then I saw it and I was like, I need to buy that. And then I saw that... that woodcut print on lambskin, and I was like instantly drawn to that instead, and I debated my life in general over that instead of the companion. I apologize.
Did you just admit a couple things? One is that a lambskin thing is better than like 800 pages of content. The other thing is, this is a question, two-part question. Mm-hmm. Did you just admit you don't have one yet?
I did admit that. I was not able to get in on the Kickstarter because of financial issues at the time. I do have an old version of the companion, the you know what I'm talking about, Brett, the pre yes. This release one.
The 0.9 version.
Yes, and so I have that, but I don't have the newer version that's been released recently.
All right, fair enough.
And I've mentioned that in the last show as well, so I don't feel bad saying it again.
It's okay. I don't have every book.
Prosecution rests.
Exactly. Right.
I may have I may have 6 copies of the companion. But.
Yeah, you have a lot of the copies. You have every color of binding.
Yeah, yes.
You have all of them.
Some of those may get sold to send my kids to college, but...
Oh, YSDC has released all of its actual play recordings for free.
That's insane.
They are... They're celebrating 12 years of actual play recordings, and they played through... It said 10 epic adventures. Obviously, 10 one-shots. They're not. They're campaigns, mostly. And they happened between September 2005 and September 2017. That is...
I think they're cycling a few in and out just for server load issues, but I think they have like 6 of them available now, and we'll have all of them out by the end of the year.
Awesome.
That's insane. And they're going to start, they're going to continue doing their actual plays, but they're going to start playing his Paul's sort of homebrew Lovecraftian horror system and scenarios they wrote themselves instead of playing other people's campaigns.
What?
Yes.
What are you talking about? Did he mention that on new, YSDC?
You mean from the new episode of News from Dakotas today? Yes, he did.
I didn't hear it yet. Well, what do you mean homebrew? What are you talking about?
He's created his own sort of... He said it's longer than Cthulhu Dark, but shorter than the Cthulhu Hack, his own system.
Huh.
A rules-light version of a Lovecraftian horror. It is not Call of Cthulhu.
I'm fascinated. When are those coming out?
I don't know if there's a released set for those. I think they're starting to play it. He's got, I think, just 1 or 2 copies of his in-house rules, which he kept saying is terrible, which is, I think, not a great way to sell it to people. But
no, he says the
terrible
rules...
new game. Maybe he means terrible in like the frightening, terrifying way, not the
sure
awful, bad way. So.
Hmm.
But yeah, check it. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Settle down now, Klaus. It's time for your next lesson.
Topics. So, all right. Yes. Brett, you're on the show for an actual reason.
Yes, I am.
You have something you wish to speak about.
Yes, I do. So we are hopefully wrapping up our Kickstarter for the third issue of the Arkham Gazette. We're sort of turned into a revamp of issues 1 and 2 as well, and issue 0 even got in the mix there. Issue 2 is currently being laid out by Chris Huth, who does our layout work, but he was sort of eaten by Gen Con, and I hope we'll have an update to our Kickstarter explaining this before this episode comes out, but he's a bit behind in getting the layout done for various reasonable reasons, because he had several other projects that need to be done as well. So... the issue 2 is not out, but that's pretty much wrapping up the Kickstarter.
Nice.
Which leaves, well, I mean, there are a couple outstanding stretch goals, but I haven't forgotten them, but they're not hanging over my head like the Sword of Damocles anymore. So I think it's time to put out something else. And the project I'm working on is a reboot of an old Call of Cthulhu scenario, previously published by a Chaosium licensee. The scenario is The Dare, by Kevin Ross. It was published originally by Triad Entertainments in their book Dwellers in Shadow. Or is it... Make sure... Dwellers in Shadow. I always get it Dwellers or Dweller. Dwellers in Shadow in 1996. And I don't think most people have heard of it. So
wow.
We are rebooting it for the 7th edition.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, rebooting and making some changes here and there. Expanding, right?
Yeah, I mean, We're updating the edition, obviously, that's the one element, but we're also offering a little bit of expansion. It's, you know, not a whole rewrite, but it's offering some Game Master suggestions, doing a little bit of rule simplification. So if you want to run this as a Halloween one-shot for your friends who don't normally RPG, or maybe some kids, if you found some neighborhood children wandering around, invite them in with candy and have a game for them. The reason I mention kids is you actually play sort of preteens, like 11, 12 year olds in the scenario, who are compelled to explore a haunted house. And I think with the season, Halloween coming up, the release of It, the second season of Stranger Things, I think it's a good time to play a kid in a horrible situation.
Yeah, it's always a good time to play kids in a horrible situation.
Yes. So yeah, we've got the scenario. It's a classic sort of haunted house scenario. It's I think it's a fun piece. I've always liked Kevin's work. People may know him from all sorts of things. The Kingsport Guide, the latest edition of Gaslight, and everything in between. I think Down Darker Trails he just did.
Yeah.
He has a whole bibliography of works out there. There's some really high quality top scenarios. The first King and Yellow scenario, I think, he did with Have You Seen the Yellow Sign? And a lot of stuff out there. So, you know, Kevin was very kind to give us permission to reprint the scenario since he had the rights to it, and gave us his blessing to tinker with it a bit. And Chaosium signed off on having us do a little bit of rules tweaking to make it. The scenario only called on maybe a dozen skills, and so we combined a couple down. We merged I think jump and climb into one skill called gym class. They make maybe a little more sense to the average person when they start to play, and reduce the number of skill groups that our kids have to have, because they're 10. They don't have all sorts of skills, and the biggest weapon they have is a cherry bomb. So
yeah,
no dynamite, no shotguns, BB guns and cherry bombs.
Awesome. And what's the schedule for this thing?
It has a somewhat tight turnaround.
Hello, this is Keeper Chad from the future with a little insert to update. We're about to talk about the schedule for Brett's Kickstarter for The Dare, but the dates are out of whack because we recorded this a while ago. So the Kickstarter is scheduled to go live this week and will only last for 10 days. So keep an eye on the show notes for the link when it goes live. I was never here. I was never here.
Soon after, it depends on, obviously there's other parties working. I've got some art being done for the book, and layout will of course need to be done as well. So I've got that lined up. I can't confirm the people doing it quite yet. Nothing else. I will have the scenario ready for you to have a little bit of fun this Halloween season. And hopefully not die. I could laugh deeper. How's that?
Whoa.
That was Skeletor.
Oh, He-Man.
That's better.
I can't do a good Skeletor.
Yeah, so it's really a one-shot scenario. We're going to try to avoid any ridiculous stretch goals. No tote bags, no mugs. No foreign excursions to do research.
Take that, Kickstarters who do tote bags.
Yeah, suck it, Ken Height. We'll have a few add-ons. I think Kevin's agreed to write an introduction as a stretch goal. Maybe recommend some horror movies to watch to get in the mood to run it. Offer some expanded NP or player characters from some different eras. I think the default setting we're going to have is 80s. And then offer up like a 20s version and a modern version, and maybe a special stretch goal. I don't know if you want to talk about that one, Chad.
Special stretch goal of pregens?
Yeah.
Sure. We are talking about putting children versions of Mythos Circle and Pulp Writers. Actually, I don't know how to frame it. You should do this.
Yeah, I think I've commandeered an author to make up a set of Lovecraft Circle, some of them, and then some other pulp authors from the era as child investigators in some sort of nebulous, pre-20s era. So you can have a chance to have Lovecraft himself explore the haunted house as a adolescent.
Right. So names include Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard. Are we even sure what the list is at this point?
We've talked about some names. We haven't narrowed it. We haven't finalized anything yet. I think you're pretty solid on
Clark Ashton Smith.
Clark Ashton Smith, yeah. A handsome lad.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. He's got that one picture. It sort of looks like he works in a coal mine, I always think.
It's his Sharpie fit photo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Elizabeth Brun. Nope. Don't say Elizabeth.
Nope.
Damn it.
Not Elizabeth.
Margaret Brundage.
Who yes.
Is
I almost said Elizabeth too.
I know. Elizabeth Brundage, by the way, is a Kingsport NPC. So probably a name similarity there. Margaret Brundage is the illustrator for many, many Weird Tales covers in the 30s. I think to 1933 to 38 or 9. The ones that were sort of scantily clad women in bondage, half bondage poses. And
yes.
She got Weird Tales in kind of some trouble with that. She was penning as M. Brundage. And so people didn't know she was a woman for a long time. And interesting character. And then she married a hobo.
Wow.
She did.
That's news to me.
Yeah, she married a radical lefty hobo who they had a whole weird scene in Chicago. They had their own little tavern. I'm forgetting what the name is now, but sort of a hotbed of radical movement there.
Wow.
And yeah, she's a super interesting character.
Well, thank you for doing that research to make those player characters for us, Chad.
Sure thing. That's super fun. So you can play Mythos characters in little versions in Call of Cthulhu.
Do you guys like playing as children in Mythos games or horror games in general?
Very much.
That's a change of pace, yes.
I mean, I've not done it very often, so I can't say that I'm a fan or not.
I've only done it once, but I thought it was really fun.
I think there's something that can be... I mean, you know, I think when it comes to the scenarios, they have to be well constructed. It's not just, you know, playing a bunch of kids going through the haunting wouldn't be all that much fun. There has to be some special reason why you have the investigators you do. You know, like, say, you know, the adults in the town can't see the monster, for example.
Nice one.
Yeah, for a strange example. But, or, you know, or a circumstance where, you know, adults either wouldn't take interest or wouldn't be located. You know, sort of, I guess, Lord of the Flies meets Cthulhu sort of thing. And you can go dark, but you don't have to. I think people are a little reluctant to have, you know, children in certain forms of harm's way. So we're going to offer, actually, as notes in this scenario, how to run it PG or maybe PG-13 or R, you know, depending on your players and their, you know, interests. You know, because you can definitely, you know, you can lighten up the tone a little bit. This is not, you know, sort of a grim, dark scenario that has to be bleak, but it's also horror. So you can have, you know, creepy, disturbing things, but you don't always have to go for the blood and guts or the, you know, maim, murder, kill sort of horror that some people think you have to. I like sort of implied horrors just as much as the revealed ones, if not more so. So, you know, I think kids in the right scenario can be a lot of fun. I know Oscar Rios has written some, I think, a pair of Lovecraft Country scenarios where you play children, Halloween and Dunwich and Christmas in Kingsport.
Yeah.
I always kick back to the Benjamin Baugh RPG Monsters and Other Childish Things.
Oh, yeah.
That Art Dream put out back in like 08 or so.
Have you played that?
I managed to get a copy of that and one of the scenario books for it, I believe, and I have never been able to play it. I don't have a local group to play it with, so I've just never been able to. It uses Stoltz's Aura engine, or the One Roll engine. So it's kind of, it's not, I'm not going to say it's a rules light, but it's a simplistic method of dice pools. It's not kind of like your typical White Wolf style dice pool. But it's a really interesting take on gaming as children. The premise there is that monsters exist and some children have monsters, right? And that those monsters could be anything. Like they could be like giant and big and scary with a giant fuming nostrils, right? And these nostrils can, maybe they can smell your worst fear, or they can shoot giant snot balls across. And yeah, there's all sorts of strange stuff that could be used in game. It's really interesting. I've just never had the chance to play it.
It sounds neat. I've read some good reviews of it, but never had a chance to play it myself.
Yeah, it looks really, really good. I'd like to play it. I just never have been able to.
I heard there's an actual play on Role Playing Public Radio from way back.
Yeah.
I think Ross Payton wrote for the game a little bit, so they were playtesting. But it always sounded really cool to me.
I have to confess, I've always kind of wanted to turn the plot of Pete's Dragon into a Call of Cthulhu scenario.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
The Gogans could be from Dunwich.
Nice.
Pete's the dragon is obviously a Ligor. Come on.
I've always wanted to do, and this is not related at all, but since we're doing this, I've always wanted to do the Burbs. Because why wouldn't you? You know what I mean?
That would be awesome.
It would be fantastic.
Isn't the scenario the lock-in, is that what it's called? Is that for...
That's, I think John wrote that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's John's scenario. And that's, yeah, his...
That's for children, right?
I think teens, but yeah.
Yeah, you play teens at a lock-in in high school or middle school, something like that.
And I don't think any of us have played Tales... Wait, is it Tales of the Loop or Tales from the Loop?
I think it's from the Loop, but I'm just guessing.
The Swedish one? I haven't played it. I have the books. They are, or the PDFs, I should say. They are really well done. Magnus has been wanting to run us through that, and we have just not gotten around to it.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a tonal difference, though, when you're running teens versus running younger children. Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, slasher films are based entirely upon teens doing stupid stuff at the lake cabin, but
yeah, Tales from the Loop though has more of the feel of kind of like Stranger Things, though.
That's good. Yeah, I was just it's interesting to see how the tone shifts when the kids just once you go through puberty. Apparently, the monsters are allowed to gut you.
Yeah, I mean, well, sex becomes exactly sex, blood, and violence is open door there.
I think a part of that too is that the films that have those teenagers, the teenagers are usually played by people who are actually adults too. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy there.
There was a novel a couple of years ago, I think called The Troop, about a group of Boy Scouts on an island something very terrible happens to.
I have heard about that. I have not read it, but I know what you're speaking
I had it
about.
Recommended to me, but I've not read it either.
Same here. It's something strange. I don't know what happens because I wanted to read it and haven't got there yet.
I think it's pretty gory. It's a darker story with kids involved, but not that, you know, the Lord of the Flies was a real upbeat ending. But
and it as well is I wouldn't say that's PG. Not even PG-13, really. Depending on how faithful.
No,
I think one of the appeals to playing children in the game is similar to playing any group of people, say, mobsters or all hobos or all construction workers or whatever you might be, because I think there's a really quick shorthand to, okay, you get kind of some fast track of role-playing, right?
That's true.
I mean, I remember, Chad, you and I played that game where we were kids and we knew what to do right away. Because we could kind of steal from the great playbook of childhood or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think that's when we were making the NPCs, where I was making the NPCs for the scenario. I tried to go through the originals and I wanted to expand a little bit just because the scenario is a little older. There's only one female character. Just wanted to offer a little bit more options or a few more. Yeah, I wanted to offer just a number of options. So I tried to come up with sort of archetypes of childhood, and I think I'm pretty happy with the 10 I came up with. And hopefully the skills are balanced so you can pick whatever group of 3 or 4 or 5 or however many players you've got. And they'll all, you know, have something useful to contribute and, you know, but also get to have some fun playing at the sort of archetypes of youth.
And unlike mobsters or hobos or what have you, I mean, maybe some of us, but, you know, we've all been children, right? But we maybe haven't been some of these other things, so we can all tap into that personal experience.
Huh. That's true.
Definitely. There's also that social isolation space that's created by being children. You're all on the same plane. That's nice. It sort of sets you apart from adults.
Yeah, you're all clumped into the exact same social strata of child as opposed to middle class, lower class, upper class, whatever.
Yeah, and just easier. Kid world is intimate in a way. It's or enclosed.
There is a certain us against them mentality toward some adults sometimes. You can definitely see.
Yeah, you have the whole Charlie Brown scenario where, you know, all of the adults are just wah, 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 wah. You know, because you don't, kids just don't give a meow half the time, you know, whenever you're talking. So you have that that you can all play in together.
Yeah, and there's fun things you can do too with, you know, parents maybe not believing or kids asking themselves, how are we going to explain this to the parents? And that's fun. And I also think that I was thinking about this today as I was kind of getting my thoughts together before the show. And I was asking myself, you know, was the most scared I've ever been in my life as a child? And I don't know if I have that answer, but I think what I do have is that there's a kind of fear that I think you only have when you're a kid.
Totally.
That's different than maybe grown-up fears. I mean, you're so helpless in so many ways, and you believe in the boogeyman and
everything. It's the naivety that lends to it. It adds that air of magical to every single thing. It doesn't matter what it is, but because you have no experience to say that, you know, that's okay, that's just that, you know, you assume that, okay, that's the fucking boogeyman. He's going to get me if I don't do something, you know, if I get out of the bed after dark, I'm screwed. Don't look under the bed. You know what I mean? And it's just a thing. It's ingrained into you. But, you know, you get older, you get past it.
It also takes care of some of those issues of dealing with authority or outsourcing your investigation. Kids are, like, they can't go to the police with things, really, or they probably wouldn't.
Right. I think the point where they can and be believed is the point where you trip from a child into a teen. And that's kind of the difference. There's some sort of agency there that happens, you know, where you hit an age of reason there where people, grown-ups, quote-unquote grown-ups, will more likely to agree with you or believe you as to what you're saying. And I finally thought of what I was thinking of a second ago. I was thinking of Something Wicked This Way Comes by Bradbury.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there you go. Sure.
Which is a kind of like my perfect example of, like, if I want to play a child game, like if I want to do monsters and other creatures, I would like it to be in that sort of creepy, rundown, almost us against them type feel to it. You know what I mean?
You know, I was just listening to Rachel Watches Star Trek,
right?
A podcast I'm enjoying very much, and they just covered Miri, the episode where,
yes,
yeah, it's so good.
Bonk bonk on the head.
Yeah, it's so creepy. And I watched it. I'm sort of watching them in conjunction with the podcast so I can, you know, revisit them all. And talk about the horror of childhood. It's very Lord of the Flies kind of world. But children themselves can cause a special kind of fear that adults, I think, don't necessarily.
Yeah, creepy kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially parents, though. I mean, there's something about, you can look at a kid and just think, what the hell is, like Children of the Corn, you know what I mean? Like,
yep, sure.
You see a bunch of prim and properly dressed, you know, children standing mute in the field next to each other, just staring wide-eyed. It's unnerving.
Well, what's that John Carpenter, what's the Cronenberg movie, The Brood?
With the blonde kids?
Yeah, well, there's the Village of the Damned.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, The Brood is a creepy film where I think the kids are all off in the woods being monsters.
And then there's The Omen, of course.
Yeah. Damien.
Yeah, The Omen. Yeah, and they just rebooted that as a TV series this past year.
Hmm.
Huh.
It picks up with Damien is older. And there's two spinoffs of The Omen, actually. There's one that's coming out here recently that's got, like, Paul Rudd starring in it. And he's Damien's stepdad, and then it's a comedy, obviously. And then there's the rehashing of The Omen as a TV series, where Damien is actually a young adult or a you know, 20 something.
Well, of course, there's also Good Omens, which is the Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman collaboration, which is basically the Omen written by much funnier people.
I'm trying to remember the name of the Twilight Zone episode. That was in the movie that where the kid who sort of lives cartoons and turns people into.
I think it's Bill Mumy or Mummy plays the kid, and they parodied it on The Simpsons.
Okay.
When he's mad, he puts you in the cornfield, I think.
Oh, yeah, gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, kids are, I mean, you know, kids are, especially as children, scary.
That,
yeah.
It's a Good Life. Wasn't that called It's a Good Life? Was that that episode?
Yeah, I think you're correct.
By, yeah, that's what it is. It's a Good Life by Jerome Bixby was the guy who wrote it. Season 3, it. Episode 8. Just found it.
So, for our next topic, Nick, you're the one who's bringing this to the table. You have posed an interesting question for all of us.
Yeah, it's what real world location, place inspires your Lovecraftian imagination? I think that there are, you know, are places that we have spent time or visited or know well or have only encountered once or maybe even just heard about that, you know, really start to kind of get our creativity and imagination going as far as, you know, how might this intersect with the mythos or what stories could I maybe tell along the lines of Lovecraft's tales that, you know, that come out of knowing these places.
Yeah, I think it's a question that's sort of springs many answers to mind. Do you have one you want to do an opening bid, something you had in mind?
I have a kind of a quick answer because it's kind of a standard answer for me. But you know, I'm somebody who has been going out to the Isles of Shoals, which are these small remote islands off the coast of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which has about 11 miles of seacoast. But these islands are a part of it, and there's a lot of great history out there, and it's got all the New England stuff that, you know, I think right away, you know, almost any place in New England, it's Lovecraft country, it's going to inspire the Lovecraftian imagination. But I think also by being remote and windswept and all the history of, you know, pirates and ghosts, and it's easy to start wondering, you know, maybe there's a Lovecraftian explanation behind this ghost story or this pirate story. Something else too that I think is a part of the Lovecraft experience is when things are scary but also oddly beautiful and attractive too. And I think that the Isles of Shoals are like that. There not only are these wonderful tales of murder and mayhem and ghosts and pirates, but it's also an incredibly breathtaking place. And that combination, I think, stirs something Lovecraftian inside of me. I think about, you know, the shadow over Innsmouth when the protagonist is describing life under the sea in ways that sounds appealing.
Mm.
It's not all a bad thing to have the taint maybe in his eyes and to frolic in the waves. So I think that combination of fear and beauty can be very compelling. And I would say that the Isles of Shoals do that.
Yeah, fear and beauty, absolutely. I had thought about I have many, unfortunately, but fear and beauty in combination. A place that I think of is called Cobscook Bay, way up in the northern border of Maine, on the coast, and it's this massive bay, not far from the Bay of Fundy, so sort of historically high tides, and it's this whole big area that floods and recedes every tide, and the landscape changes from hour to hour. So islands appear and disappear. There are actually reversing falls where you can see the flow of the river or flow of a piece of the bay change, where there's actually a waterfall in both directions. And just that whole idea of a sort of living bay that from moment to moment changes is both beautiful and terrifying to me.
Sounds almost dreamlike.
Mm, sure. Yeah, or nightmarish. There's a moment when the tide is at slack where everything stops and the creatures are all apparently trained to know when this happens. And the seals will come up and start frolicking in ways that I think what happens is the fish behavior changes and they start hunting. Maybe they get confused or, you know, I don't know.
what is working under the water there, but you just have all these predators preying on the sea surface. And so sort of like vicious and beautifully suspended at the same time in a weird dream space. Murph, you got a location that tickles your horror?
I went just a different route, actually, but I got a couple, I suppose. So I grew up going back and forth to visit family in Louisiana. And so New Orleans, especially the French Quarter, for me, has always been kind of a strange, scary, magical place. It's filled with history. For the South, it's a lot of history, you know what I mean? Because down this way, we don't have a lot of the history like the Northeast does. But New Orleans does. It's some crazy history in there, some weird stuff. There's the whole voodoo thing that went down. And then if you go just outside of New Orleans, you get to the Atchafalaya River Basin, to the swamp. And that is freaky. If you've ever been out in the swamp before and all you see is just miles and miles of bayous and little cuts in water, and then occasionally you'll hit a big body of water, and then cypress trees everywhere, and these, you know, these little islands of floating sod and alligators coming in, Spanish moss hanging down all around you, and it's gorgeous, but at the same time it's really eerie at times, especially when the fog rolls in early in the morning. It can be unsettling even. Sometimes you'll find shacks just left out in the swamp that have been there for who knows how long. Little hunting lodges from the 30s or the 20s maybe even, that are just abandoned because you can't actually use them anymore. Or the water's risen up above so that they're half submerged. So you just see like the top halves of these little wooden buildings that are still standing there because they were all made out of cedar from back in the day anyway. It's really... That, I think, is probably, if I had to pick like a location like you guys have mentioned, that would probably be mine. Outside of that, though, I would have to say either New Orleans and the French Quarter, or even up going in, because I'm from the South, going northeast again to like Providence and Boston. I really enjoy those cities, and just walking around, you can feel the history, especially in Providence because everything's so close and so tight together, and it just kind of sparks off of everything, and that's probably also tied because we spend every couple of years we go to Necronomicon in Providence for me, and so the two are almost intimately intertwined for me now in that sense. But I think those would be the two spots for me that I can think of, or three or four, whatever I named.
Yeah, those are some really evocative descriptions. I really like the image of a shack kind of half underwater and half coming out, and
it's really strange. You can come across, like, I remember being out there once, and you come down a bayou that you haven't been down before, and there's a piece of land in front of you that's cut off from everything else. There's nothing around it. It's surrounded by water, and there's a mobile home and a truck on it, and you're like, what? Like, how the hell did that get there? You know what I mean? It's like, obviously they had it on a barge and they brought it out there and they stuck it on this little piece of land. But why? Like, what are they thinking? That they're going to drive out someday? Like that, I mean, in that alone, you think about it for long enough and you're like, okay, either these people are fucking stupid or they know something we don't. And like,
yeah.
I mean, it's literally like a 200-foot piece of land with a travel trailer and a truck on it. Like, why? Why even bother? In a little rickety old dock where they put their John boats up and airboats or whatever. But it's like, does he sit in the truck at night and listen to the radio? Like,
just drive circles around the island.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. But it's not the only time you find stuff like that out there. You'll come across a piece of land that'll have just a car just sitting there from like the 40s. And it's all rusted out and everything. And you're like, okay, well, maybe this is from when the water was... lower, and he could actually drive out here potentially, maybe, although that doesn't even make sense. So it's not like that's the first time that, you know what I mean? You see weird stuff out there, it can get weird, especially if you're gator hunting.
Sure.
Well.
Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah, no, right.
Well, sorry. I am from the South.
Have you been gator hunting?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. How does that go down?
You put giant hooks with chicken on it, and you tie it to a tree.
Okay.
So you tie a huge stainless steel hook onto a rope, and you tie the rope to the tree, and you dangle the chicken that you've hooked onto it off of a limb or something that's just like wrapped once or twice around this limb, and so it hangs over the water or just into the water. And then you just leave it and you come back the next day. You set out about 30 of those.
Oh, it's like a trap.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fishing line. It's just hanging there all night because they're not going to mess with it. You're standing there. And then you come back the next day. If the thing has been pulled off of the tree, then there's a good chance there's an alligator on it. And then you have to grab onto the line, pray that you have the strength to hold on and you don't slice your hands to pieces. And then you get this giant alligator to the side of the boat, you shoot him in the back of the head, and you roll his huge butt into the boat with you. Repeat over and over again.
Then you bring it to your island with the truck on it.
Then you bring it. Well, see, that's the thing, is you have to have they only do this certain time of the year. There's a season for it. And you have to have a license to do it. It's very regulated. So whenever you do finish, you have to go and you have to present your catch, and here's my license and here's what I got today. And there's the ones. And then they immediately, though, they're processed right then and there, because you can take the meat, but typically you sell the skins. And so they'll skin it right there in front of you. If you want to keep the skins, you can, to have your own boots made or whatever, but that's expensive. Most people just sell the skins and get rid of it, and you just get to keep the meat.
It sounds like Stanley Kubrick directing a version of Jurassic Park.
It's a lot of fun, is what it is. I know it sounds ridiculous to people who don't hunt or fish, but it's a blast.
Is it? Do you actually have a document with your face on it that says, you know, alligator license?
No. No, it's a yearly thing. You can only get it. What I had was a temp license that you get whenever you're going out with someone who has a primary license.
Gotcha.
So I was allowed to accompany someone else, the actual guy, out. And so we went out with him and we checked his lines and set up his lines the one day and then checked them the second day and processed and whatnot, drinking.
Well, your story really creeped me out. Brett, that was all. Oh. Yeah.
Well, I'll follow up on that one. You know, it's kind of hard. Like, I don't want to just sort of, I having lived in New England, I there are definitely places that, you know, sort of put me in a Lovecraft mood. I'd say that for real world place, Purgatory Chasm, has anybody been?
No.
It's south of Worcester, Mass. I think it's in I think it's in Sutton, Mass. It's this probably a glacial chasm that was produced by an outflow from one of the sort of receding glacial lakes. And it's this, like, I think it's a quarter of a mile or half a mile crack in the earth. It's just made of jumbled boulders. And it's, you know, it's a nice walk and you can hike around. There's some little caves formed by the rockfall. But the first time I went there, I'm like, this is Dunwich. Like, this is like the end of the chasm. I expect like the Dunwich horror to be sleeping, you know, because it's just these huge boulders. It's like a 70 or 80 foot drop on each side of this very narrow space. And, you know, even though there are marked trails and, you know, it's a very habited place by people. Just if you can get there at the right time and there aren't a lot of hikers or, you know, a group of school kids screaming their head off as they run through it, you know, it's a very sort of primal, you know, nature, but not sort of something, it's a little bit off nature. Like something bad happened here and you can't quite figure out what it was. There's this sort of spore of destruction that's, you know, ripped this gash in the earth that, you know, nature's sort of patched over, but there's still a scab. And I thought that was an eerie, sort of interesting place. I'd recommend visiting if you're ever in the area.
Cool.
You know, but there are other things sort of, I guess, get my Lovecraftian vibe going. You know, I used to have these recurring dreams about, like, going... I was in a house and trying to leave the house, and every time I went up a flight of stairs, I just found a different attic space and sort of a never-ending series of these rooms that just went on and on and on, sort of a... You know, this is long before I had ever read, like, Night Floors or any of those scenarios, or sort of Carcosa of, you know, of a place, but, you know, I've tried to work that into a scenario once or twice. I've got an outline of one, but of a house that just doesn't end. You can't escape it. It's sort of every time you know, open a door, there's a new room beyond. And that's, you know, that I haven't had that dream in a long time. But as a kid, it wasn't quite a nightmare. It was always sort of fun to explore the house. But I imagined, you know, what if I was actually trying to get away and not explore? If I was trying to escape, it would be a really terrifying experience.
Yeah.
So I've come back to that. I've not quite got quite distilled it down yet in the scenario, but I like that one a lot. That's on my to-do list.
That is good. The never-ending place, I think, is featured in a lot of my dreams, trying to get out of a place and not reaching the level of panic, but just there's another door and then another thing and just sort of plodding along.
And sometimes I have the version of the dream where I'm in a bookstore that's a never-ending, and that's the happy dream. And then I realize, like, and then I find a book that I know doesn't exist. I'm like, ah, crap, it's a dream.
I have the same thing, but this was one of my original ones that I thought of is just the concept of being in the forest, you know, where you're in that ancient pre-timber cut forest, you know, and it's just dark and eerie and you can see forever in every direction because there's no undergrowth because the canopy is so thick. The sun is supposedly shining. It's daytime maybe, but you can't actually tell. And it's just trunks of trees everywhere, you know, as far as you can see in any direction. And that's kind of one of the same locations for me. It's not an actual location. It's just kind of something in my head, I guess.
Yeah, for me, another class of very scary place is abandoned buildings. I've always been interested in skulking around abandoned buildings, and in fact, for several Halloweens, tried to find an abandoned building as my Halloween treat. So decay is kind of an aspect of that, sort of an Innsmouth-y decay that I like. Seeing things in decline, seeing things that were built for use that were sort of shiny and right once upon a time that are now past their prime. One of the most interesting things for me in those buildings is to find something that feels very alive, like a pack of cigarettes on a desk, but that's, you know, got dust all over it. You can sort of feel the life of the people that were inside it and just this careless gesture. But I don't know, something about that gives me cognitive dissonance when in an abandoned building and I see a broom propped up against something or, you know, some immediate sign of habitation.
Yeah, that gives me a lot of memories, Chad, of a place you and I have both lived, where we went to college in Orono, Maine, which, you know, now is kind of a quaint college town, but at one point had a lot of industry and so therefore has a lot of old brick factories that have become abandoned.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of them I had a chance to explore and some of them I just would look at and wonder what they were like inside. And I think that combination of wondering and never finding out, and also of being able to also do some discovery and exploration stimulates my imagination.
Yeah, totally. Actually, having that part of a place, going around an abandoned building and then having that part that you can't go into and still having wonder, it leaves the horror.
Yeah.
You know, it leaves the shark under the waves in a way. It's very scary.
You know, one other one, if I can add another one there, is, you know, driving at night, especially when it's a little foggy out, in a place that's not well lit, you know, a backcountry road or something, maybe a night with maybe a lot of clouds, a little bit of moonlight, and you sort of occasionally see buildings, but you can't see anything for too long, so you have to focus on the road, and you know, you're trying to find a radio station and you sort of half get a signal coming in, but you can't quite make out what they're saying. And, you know, that's disturbing in its own way.
Have you guys ever been in a situation that, looking back on it, was just either a horrible, horrible place to be in, and looking back, you're like, okay, that's not, well, that could be Lovecraftian, but...
Yes.
I've been in the New York Port Authority at 4 a.m.
Yep, that'll do it.
An old lady walked up to me and said I was the son of the devil. She then told the guy behind me waiting for a bus that he was the son of the devil, and then she told the drinking fountain next to us that it was the son of the devil. She couldn't be all right.
It's a moving target. Son of the devil's always on the move.
He's a busy devil. That drinking fountain is evil.
I wouldn't drink from it.
I know, right?
Well, there was this one time I was trying to find a cemetery in near, I think it was Ashburnham, Massachusetts. And I was just driving, like, I knew it was roughly where it was. It was like between these two roads. So I just was driving down all these sort of barely marked country roads. And I came up over a rise, and there's this old farmhouse. It's kind of weather beaten and it's in need of a paint job. And it's, I think it might have been their driveway that I was going down. And this ancient man who I would say like a skinny Alan Moore, like the huge beard and hair, holding this chain of a mastiff, sort of steps out from beside the building and sort of gives me a flinty glare as I slowly drive by, because it's dirt road. And, you know, I look at the place, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm near Dunwich. I should keep going. I want to get back to Aylesbury right away. I did not stop.
I had that here. I had that here in my area when I was house hunting way back when, I guess about 10 years ago. We went to look at a house out in the sticks, man, like out in the middle of nowhere. And when we finally found it, we get on this dirt road. It was a straight up dirt road. And there's this Tyson's chicken farm on one side. The other side had these little shacks. And there's this really nice house down the road, which is what we were going to look at. But to get there, we had to drive down this little road. All of the yellow caution signs, it was funny that they had signs at all, because I'm on a dirt road, but they had these yellow caution signs. They all had swastikas spray painted on them. And then there's, like, I shit you not, like little inbred children running around the car as I'm trying to get down to this house to view it. And when we get to the house, I realize that what I thought was a barn was actually the neighbor's house, which was a shack that was literally like 2.5 feet away from the wall of the house we were supposed to look at. And there was, yeah, like a mountain man style meth head redneck standing out there with like 15 kids and like 18 dogs and swastikas everywhere. And we just shot a Yui in the driveway and just got the hell out of Dodge, because that was just a weird spot to be in. But yeah, it was weird, strange. And then the overpowering smell of chicken farm. That never goes over well.
Yeah. Little Hills Have Eyes experience there.
Yeah. You know, once I had I think I may have told the story before, I was looking for a summer job and I got this number to call for some guy, and I called it, and you know, he says, Brett, are you looking for adventure? Like, what kind of adventure? Well, see, I run a carnival. You'd come along with us for the carnival for the summer. You'd work setup and tear down. So, do you like adventure, boy?
So it's literally the intro to Something Wicked This Way Comes. I mean, you are going to be one of the carnies.
Practically. Yeah, but my parents wouldn't let me do it, so... Like, I like adventure, sure.
You sold me, man.
I love set up and tear down.
Those rides seemed safe.
These cardboard screws will work.
Well, I worked in a haunted mansion. I'm trying to think. There's not really a story here, except that as a Lovecraftian experience, becoming the monster in a amusement park ride haunted mansion, so dressing up and putting the makeup on and scaring children all day long, it does something to your brain.
Does it really?
Locked in a cage under heat lamps and just spend, you know, especially sort of 4th of July weekend or one of the big amusement park weekends, and just for 8 hours a day, you are screaming at children.
I taught. I know what that's like.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was a high schooler.
I have kids.
8 hours, that was it.
Good point.
I mean...
Good point. But the Lovecraft of that experience is the sort of becoming part monster, I think.
Yeah.
I could see that.
I think mine, my ultimate one would then be when I sink a boat 20-something miles offshore in the ocean.
On purpose?
And
sure.
Yeah, Brett. I did it on purpose because I felt that needed to be done. No. That was an experience I needed to check off my bucket list. Sink boat in ocean.
Well,
survive was optional.
You could have been catfished by a mermaid. Who knows?
No, I mean, I could have been, but I wasn't. No, I was in a fishing tournament when I was younger, and it was bad weather already, but it turned really bad, and it was like 8 to 10 foot seas, and we were in a 25-foot, you know, outboard motor, dual outboards on a 25-foot Hydrosport, big fishing boat, but not quite big enough. Anyway, the boat ended up taking on water, and it rolled, long story short. And my dad was with me, and some other guys were with us. And I remember that moment when, like, I knew it was going to sink. We all knew it was going to sink. Dad was on there trying to broadcast out to the Coast Guard where exactly in the hell we were, because the EPIRB did not work.
Oops.
And the life raft we decided not to take because it took up too much room that morning.
Sure.
So that's like, yeah, I can't make that up. We really had that conversation. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's too damn big. Let's not take it this time.
And the safety chain breaks.
Yeah. So whenever the boat rolled, I walked the hull as it rolled. So I didn't get in the water. I like had one leg over and it flipped, and I just like stood up on that other leg and just walked the boat as it flipped over. And so I was standing on the back of this boat, and I had to sit down fairly promptly, obviously, but you know. Anyway, I remember my dad was under the boat, and he was up underneath this hard top, and he couldn't get out real easy. And I remember that moment where I'm sitting up there on the top of this boat, and I'm all of like 19, and I'm thinking, that's all right. Dad's dead.
Wow.
That sucks. I guess I'm going to have to go in and get him, right? Because that was my mental thinking. I'm going to have to go get him. All right. So I was mentally preparing myself to dive in. And then my dad is goofy, right? He wore a Gilligan hat. He always did when we were fishing out there, because it would burn his ears, you know. So he had a Gilligan's style white canvas hat on, and I remember seeing this hat float up.
Oh my God!
To the surface of the ocean, and I'm like, shit. In my head, it's just like a freaking movie, man. This hat just floated to the surface, and then it clicked in my brain. He had that stupid string around his chin, and there's my dad's like gasping face popping up underneath the hat. And I get a hold of him, and I pull him up onto the top of this flipped over boat, and I get in the water. I swim in like 500 gallons of gasoline for the next few hours.
Ugh.
Kept the sharks away, so that was cool. Some of us got hurt in that excursion, but the Lovecraftian part of it is when you're sitting out there in the ocean and you're coming to terms with the fact that this could very well be it.
Yikes.
And you're only 19. You know what I mean? And there's nothing anywhere. You know, as far as you can see is nothing but storm clouds and waves. If you can only see when you get to the top of a wave. And then you have about a second or two to glimpse whatever is around you. And then you just go back down to the bottom really, really hardly. You know, so you're just constantly getting battered. And then you get to the bottom and you look up and all you can see is storm clouds and water. And then you go up and you see storm clouds and water. And you go down and you see storm clouds and water. And so we did that for a few hours.
Wow.
Unsure as to whether or not the message had gotten out. And it does something to you. You kind of find out who you are and who the people you were with are, you know, at that particular moment, because you're kind of stuck into this spot and you're like, that's it. You know, like one guy was up on the front of the boat on the anchor outcrop, and every 10-foot wave would come up, he would get picked up in the air, and then he would get dropped 10 feet back onto that anchor outcrop, and it tore him the hell up. But he cried the whole time. I mean, it was just a mess, man. But it was interesting looking back on it. It's like, okay, I would go boating with all of me and my dad again. I wouldn't do it with anyone else again, in that scenario, from that group, at least, I should say. But at the same time, it was an eerie place to be out in the middle of the ocean with certain death looming over you, and you're just kind of stuck there, and there's nothing you can do about any of it. And it's that Lovecraftian feeling of the complete and utter indifference of nature, and doesn't give a shit what you do. It's just going to barrel you down and slam another wave on you, and you know, eventually you're just going to give up and let go of the handhold, and that's that.
Yeah.
It's an impressive feeling. But at the same time, when that Coast Guard boat showed up, it was a really happy feeling to know that you didn't have to worry about that no more. So that was, you know, you get both of it in such a short time span. It's like going to a horror movie, only amplified a million times, because you're actually living the horror. And then immediately you're relieved because there's your exit and it's all good and everything's fine. You know, and it messes with your head a little bit. But I guess that would be my, like, ultimate Lovecraftian moment from real life, was being out in the middle of the ocean, certain death looming, and nowhere can you see anything but the harsh reality of nature.
Now, I think that's such a great story, and I feel like where this can be of utility to people who run games out there is not only the whole, you know, the Lovecraftian horror of your personal experience, but... You know, both listening to you tell that story and also the alligator hunting story, I got really excited about the specific. I want to be in a game, Murph, that you run that's either about alligator hunting or about deep sea fishing, because the specificity that you bring really helps me to feel like I'm there, even something I've never done like alligator hunt. So I think that's something we can just remember as people who play the game and run games, these places that scare us or these events that have scared us. It's the detail that we can bring, right? Because we've lived it. So for listeners out there, maybe, you know, they've had other things, but they can bring those details to their game.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Totally.
All right, guys. Thank y'all for coming on last minute. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Thanks for having us. It's been fun.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. You'll have to come back, Nick. We want to hear from our listeners, and we have lots of ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is now mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner. Tell us who you are, and give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all those links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/132.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license.
Bum. The Miskatonic University role-playing game is a...
That was pretty great.
So long from me. Farewell from me.
Oh, no.
Ask for Asphagelm.
Oh, that's funny.
That's great.